Well, thank you very much, Michael James, for taking the Zoom. I've been reading your book, but also been studying your website and actually, much to my wife's chagrin, printing out all of the papers. So we've got a great pile of papers that you've written, and I thank you very, very, very much. Towards the end of this discussion, I'm hoping we'll have enough time to actually talk about the actual personal experience of drawing closer to the eye. And I'd love to pick your brain with that. And maybe if anybody ends up listening to this or watching this, it may be useful to them. As you know, I'm a retired Anglican priest, so there's a part of me that is always looking to figuring out how to give this away to others to as a blessing to them. So let's hope for that. If it, let me just set a context for our conversation. If this is true, if in fact what Bhagavan tells us is true, which I'm absolutely convinced it is, then the more and more people that get this, the more and more peaceful and joyful and blissful the world will become. It's amazing to me that it's taken this long in the evolution of of the human race, to get to this point. Although I probably shouldn't be, but it's still amazing to me that it was men and women thousands of years ago that tweaked to the comparison of sleeping and dreaming and awaking. It's not incidental, though, that I'm obviously my accent's Australian. I was and I one of my in my earlier life I was a missionary in to Aborigines in Australia, and it was hard to get the elders to talk to me, but some of them did because they began to trust me and talk to me about their dream time. And there's a lot of parallels. They understood life in very much the same way, I think, as Bhagavan, as we are beginning, as I am beginning to understand. And I'd love to have time to explore that further, and I probably will if I've given enough time. Okay, so all of this began because I've been reading on your website, your papers, and I also subscribed to a thing called Academia, and I put in the search things like waking and dreaming and sleeping and so forth, and ended up getting a number of papers, one that actually tried to debunk the profound similarity, one to one correspondence between waking and dreaming. And I sent that to you. And I honest to goodness didn't expect you to respond, but you did. And I want to tell everybody that was the most gracious thing. You didn't just give a throwaway sentence, you gave a good two-page response, which I think you ended up putting on the site. Is that correct?
Maybe. Yes, probably. I can't remember. I can't remember.
Because I love those questions and answers that you give the homepage. So putting that's something, obviously, if we could believe that waking and dreaming were identical, it would change the way we live our lives. You gave a profound response. People can go to it if they like on your website. Is there anything else you'd like to add before I go to some of the other questions I have?
Well, for me, the lack of any evidence or any good reason to suppose that our present state is anything but a dream, to me, that is very compelling. So I think it may be useful because you sent me this paper in which that is the paper is the person, just for the benefit of others, but it is the person goes through briefly some of the arguments given by Gaudapada in the second chapter of the Mandukya Karika, in which Gaudapada argues very forcibly that there is no difference between waking and dream. So this person gives a summary of those arguments and then gives his own, he tries to repudiate those arguments. To my mind, none of the arguments he gave had any weight. So if you would like to point out those arguments, what you thought is perhaps a reasonable argument, I will point out what is where the weakness in those arguments lie.
All right. I wasn't expecting this, but let's try. he makes the argument that the dreaming is very, very short compared with the daily life that we have, the waking life.
Yes.
And arguing and that, well, okay, let's forget about him, because this is, I want to get into
any arguments that in support of the idea that waking is different from dreaming.
Yes. Because while his paper prompted my thinking, I'd really like to get, and this is I wasn't planning on jumping quickly into this, but let me just say this. The idea of the one and the many.
Yes.
Please, if you're listening, I'm sorry, I'm going to jump around a bit here, but the one and the many, the idea that we feel the many because we go from the I am this and I am that. We feel the many. And we feel that in the waking and in the dreaming. And they're very, very parallel. And I can see your argument there. But when it gets down to the physics of it, I mean, when you listen to a debate about E equals MC squared or the hydrogen and H2O is what is the hydrogen bomb and so forth, the question seems to arise, or it doesn't seem to arise, the question arises because I'm trying to understand how all of that is simply a dream, both in the waking and in the sleeping. And one point, and I think I sent this in those questions I had for you. Yeah, this is the God, this is the question 5, God and the apparent laws of nature. You wrote on page 209 of your book, as we saw above, the function of God is to regulate or govern this world and all the individuals in it. His overall function of governing everything in this universe includes many aspects or sub-functions, including various material functions, such as ensuring that all the physical objects in this universe obey the various laws of nature, in quotes, the laws of mathematics, physics, chemistry, biology, and so forth. However, his most important and significant function is his most subtle one, which is to bestow his grace or blessing upon all of us individuals, souls, in such a manner as to guide us towards along the path that leads to salvation and so forth. So this idea of sustaining the laws of nature, that seems to indicate an other. Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. Do it. Well, then we have to understand the nature of God from the perspective of Bhagavan's teachings and Advaita in general. God is the one infinite whole, other than which there is nothing. Because if there was anything other than him, he would thereby be limited. So if God is infinite, as I think all theistic religions maintain that God is infinite, nothing can be other than him. And being infinite, that means there's no external limit and also no internal limit. So not only is he infinite in the sense of nothing outside himself, but he is also undivided, indivisible. He's one indivisible whole. So the argument of Advaita is that anything other than God or anything that seems to be other is just an appearance. But if all this is an appearance, to whom does it appear? It appears to me. It's in our view that all this multiplicity seems to exist. But in our view, this multiplicity seems to exist in waking and in dream, but not in sleep. So the reality of this multiplicity is immediately questionable. Any of this multiplicity, does it exist independent of our perception of it? When we're dreaming, we see many things. We see a whole universe full of many people, many objects, many events, so many things are happening. And within dreams, there also seem to be laws of nature. For example, gravity. If in dream, we, I'm sure most of us have dreamt of being on a very high or precarious place, and we have fear of falling. Why do we have fear of falling? Because of the laws of gravity apply there. However, in some dreams, certain laws of for example, in some dreams, we're able to fly. Are we thereby defying the laws of gravity? It's arguable that we are no more defying the laws of gravity than an aeroplane is defying the laws of gravity. That is, the aeroplane, by the power of aerodynamics, it's able to fly. In dream, by some powerful mind, we're able to fly. But it's not in all dreams. So generally, in dreams, there are the laws of nature in dream are generally pretty much the same as in waking state. Maybe not always exactly the same, but because in dream, anything is possible. In our present state, the state that we now take to be waking, these laws of nature seem to be very consistent. Because of this seeming consistency, science makes research trying to understand the behavior of this universe. Science doesn't actually tell us what any of these things are. All physics is able to do is to study the behavior of things. And when we find that apples invariably, when they fall from a tree, when the apple gets separated from the tree, it invariably falls down. So we infer, yes, there's some sort of attraction between physical objects. And when you have a very big physical object, it has a stronger power of attraction. So this Earth has a strong power of attraction. Smaller objects obviously have less power of attraction. So we know that if you go to a moon, which is a much smaller object than this Earth, the power of gravity is weaker. So you can you seem to be not so heavy or whatever. Whereas if you go to a very large planet like Jupiter or something, the power of gravity would be greater. So all these seem to be the case. And so science studies all these things. But all science is based on an assumption that all these things exist independent of our perception of them. In other words, science is based on the assumption that this is not a dream. Because if this were all a dream, whatever we may discover about it, it may be useful within the dream, but it's got no ultimate purpose, no ultimate benefit in knowing. Bhagavan sometimes gave the example: in a dream, you see a large building, beautiful building, and you may begin thinking, oh, how many people built, who was the architect who built this? How many masons and carpenters and other skilled workers and unskilled workers were involved in this? Where did all the materials come from? How was this all put together? You can begin to research all these things. It may be very interesting research so long as you're dreaming. You may find out about the history of that building. It was built 500 years ago, and it was built for such and such a purpose, and by in the reign of such and such a king, or whatever. I mean, so many things you may find out. You may be very interested in all those things, but as soon as you wake up, you recognize that that building was just your own mental fabrication. So science seems to be meaningful, seems to be of value, because we take this state to be something other than a dream. We make the assumption that all that this world of physical objects exists independent of our perception of them. We make exactly the same assumption in dream. In dream, we see a world, and so long as we are dreaming, that world we naturally assume that the world we are seeing exists independent of our perception of it. So when so we experience desire, in dream we experience fear, so many things, because to us it all seems to be real. If we're being chased by a monster or we're falling off a cliff, we feel fear. We try to protect ourselves. It all seems perfectly real so long as we're dreaming. But as soon as we wake up, we're able to recognize immediately, or none of that was real. It was all my own mental fabrication. Why then did it seem to be real so long as we are dreaming? And how were we able to recognize as soon as we wake up that it was not real? It seemed to be real because what is actually real in the dream is only ourself. But in the dream, we mistake a body to be ourself. So since we are real, if that body is ourself, that body is real. So we superimpose our own reality upon a body. So that body seems to us to be real. And since that body is a small part of the vast world in which it finds itself, the whole world seems to be real. So long as we are identified with that dream body. When we wake up from a dream, our identification with that dream body is severed. We no longer experience that dream body as I. As soon as that identification with the dream body is severed, we recognize, oh, it was all just a dream. It was just a mental fabrication. None of it was real. So the dream seems real so long as we experience the dream body as I. So what? And our present state is like dream in so many respects. In our present state, we experience a certain body to be I. We experience a world that seems to exist outside ourselves. We see so many people. There's actually, if we begin to consider it, there is nothing in our present state that we could not and do not experience in dreams. So there is no evidence now that this is anything but a dream. So now all this seems to be real, but perhaps it all seems to be real for the same reason that dreams seem to be real, so long as we were dreaming. But now we take this body, we experience a certain body as ourself. Since we are real, this body seems to us to be real because it seems to be ourself. And since this body is a part of this vast universe, the whole universe seems to be real. So the assumption, our natural assumption, is that whatever state we currently find ourselves in, that this is real. And but what we experience, and in this state, I am only this body. I'm not all, there are so many objects in this world. I'm just this one object, not all the other objects. So all this the inside and outside, self and other, all these come in, seem to exist only because I've limited myself with this body.
Could I jump
in
for a second?
Only when we experience ourselves as a body will we experience a world. In both waking and dream, we experience a body as ourselves, and consequently we experience a world. In sleep, that's in deep dreamless sleep, we don't experience a body as ourself, we don't limit ourselves as a body, and consequently we don't experience a world. I was just coming to the point of your question.
Go ahead.
If you want to ask,
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Your question was about God.
Yeah.
Since God is the one infinite whole, neither the subject, namely ourselves, the ego, nor any of the objects can be other than him. Because if anything was other than him, there would be a limitation on his infinity. In other words, he wouldn't be infinite. So God is the reality of both subject and object. But so long as we are looking at objects, our existence of the subject, that is, by the mere awareness of objects, is lending reality to our existence as the subject. That is, we seem to be the subject because we see objects. So we cannot find God by looking outside. because we're looking at objects, we're giving reality to, by being aware of objects, we give reality to them, and thus we give reality to ourselves as a subject. So in order to find God, we need to find God within ourselves, not outside ourselves. All the objects, all phenomena exist in whose view? Only in the view of the subject. So the objects depend for their seeming existence upon the seeming existence of ourself as the subject. The subject means ego, this limited awareness that is aware of itself as I am this body. So this is ego, and this is the subject, the perceiver of all other things. So long as we are perceiving, we are giving reality not only to the objects, but also to ourselves and the subject. So we cannot find God looking outside. Therefore, most religions, or any religion with any depth, points out to the fact the kingdom of God is within you. Look, see, the kingdom of God is within you. Jesus didn't just say, the kingdom of God is within you, believe me. He said, look, see, lo, behold, the kingdom of God is within you. So in order to know God, we need to look within. Science is looking outside. Even nowadays, science is one problem for science is consciousness. How to explain consciousness within the laws of physics and so on which all other sciences are based. So this is a problem. But if you read the modern day philosophers and neuroscientists and others who are trying to understand consciousness, they're all taking consciousness to be an object, a phenomenon, something to be studied. But consciousness is not something other than ourselves. We ourselves are consciousness. So we need to stop looking outside. We need to look within. We need to stop making research on objects, on phenomena. Make research on the one to whom all these objects and phenomena appear.
Let me jump in before I lose my thought. Two thoughts.
Right.
Well, first, the one that was most recent was this feeling of, you said, as you look out, it gives credence to your own objectivity, your own reality, as you feel it. So the more you look out, the more you feel validated.
Yeah.
You know, that gets to a point I'm going to bring up towards the end of the discussion. But whenever every morning when I get up at 6 o'clock and spend an hour or two asking the question, who am I? Mm. When I get close to really asking a question, where I feel so close to myself, I get a funny feeling. I mean, it sounds weird. We're getting very subjective here. But a strange feeling, and it's only as you were talking about it that I remembered where I got that feeling once before. And it was when the Hubble thing went out to space. And before it, what they said, turned a corner, it looked over its shoulder and took a photograph of Earth. And the only reason Earth was seen was because there was an apparent light shadow through it. And you saw the sparkling speck of dust. And when I saw that, my legs felt jelly. I lost orientation. It was a really strange feeling. I get something like that when I get very, very close to myself, to getting to answer the question, who am I? And it's almost like you're losing the balance of the outside.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, it makes perfect sense in Bhagavan's teaching. What Bhagavan says about the nature of ego, there are two verses in Uludhunapattu, which are very important in this context. In verse 24, Bhagavan says the insentient body does not say I. When he says does not say I, that's a metaphorical way of saying it is not aware of itself as I. Why is it not aware of itself as I? Because it's insentient. It has no awareness of its own. And the body, when he talks about the body, as he clarified in an earlier verse, the body doesn't just mean this physical body. It means all the five sheaves. That's the physical body, the life, the mind, the intellect, and the will. all these collectively are what we now experience as I. So this is what Bhagavan refers to as body. And these are all insentient. They're all objects. This body is an object perceived by us. The prana, the life, the breathing and everything is something perceived by us as an object. The mind with all its perceptions, memories, thoughts, feelings, and so on, it's all object. It's all things perceived by us as objects. The intellect, the functioning of the intellect, the judging, discriminating, these are all objects, things that we experience, that appear in our awareness, appear and disappear in our awareness, therefore they're objects. The will, that's all our likes, dislikes, desires, attachments, hopes, fears, and things, these are all objects. And the seeds that give rise to these, the vasanas, the inclinations that give rise to all these, they are also objects. They're things that we experience. So we are not any of these things. We are the subject. So Bhagavan says, I was talking about verse 24. So Bhagavan says, when Bhagavan says, the insentient body does not say I, what he means by body is not just this physical body, he means all these five sheaves, because collectively we experience them as ourselves. So they are not aware of themselves as I. And then in the next sentence, he says, Satchit Udiyadu. That Satchit means existence awareness. That's referring to our fundamental awareness of our own existence, what we always experience as I am. Satchit Udiyadu. Satchit does not rise. Because why does it not rise? Because it is constant and unchanging. That is, the one thing that we experience in all the three states, waking, dream, and sleep, is our own existence, our awareness of our own existence, I am. Now we're aware of ourselves as I am. In dream, we're aware of ourselves as I am. In sleep, we're aware of ourselves as I am. The difference between sleep and these other two states is that in sleep, we are aware just of I am. We're not aware of anything other than our being. Whereas in waking and dream, we are not only aware of our being, we are aware of an identity. We not only are aware of ourselves as I am, we're aware of ourselves as I am Robert, or I am Michael, or I am whoever. So there is an identification. And along with that identification comes awareness of so many other things. So coming back to verse 24, in the first sentence, Bhagavan says the body, well, in effect, he said the body is insentient, therefore it's not aware of itself as I. Satchit, the fundamental awareness of existence, doesn't rise. But between these two, one thing, I, rises as the extent of a body. In what sense does he say in between? That is, it cannot be literally in between, because Satchit, the existence awareness, is the fundamental ground, the substance of everything. So there cannot be a body other than Satchit. Nothing can exist other than existence. Nothing can be known other than independent of awareness. So Satchit is the ground. So since the body is nothing, cannot be anything other than Satchit, in what sense does Bhagavan say in between these two? You can't say that something appears between gold and the ornament, because the ornament is nothing other than gold. So Bhagavan is using this term in between in a metaphorical sense. There are two, this term in between has two significances, two implications. Firstly, if, for example, you read a story in the newspaper and you're doubtful about its how reliable that story is, you may ask a friend who's better informed than you, is this story true or false? And your friend may say, it's neither true nor false, but somewhere in between. What is the implication of in between in that sense? What it means is, it's neither entirely true nor entirely false. It has elements of truth in it and elements of fiction in it. So it's a mixture of truth and falsehood. So that's one implication of the word in between Bhagavan uses there. The other implication is the only connection between that fundamental awareness I am and all objects such as the body is this I that rises between the two of them. So this is the link between between the fundamental awareness, existence awareness, and all this multiplicity, including the body. So it's in those two senses that Bhagavan uses this term in between. So in between, one thing, I, rises as the extent of a body. In other words, he's referring to this one thing, I, is ego. And as ego, we are always limited to the extent of a body. This body is myself. I'm not anything outside this body. Whatever is outside this body is something other than myself. So we've limited ourselves to the extent of a body. And then in the next sentence, he says, this is chit-jada-granti. Chit means awareness. Jada means non-awareness or insentient. Granti means a not. So when by the rising of this ego, consciousness, the sat-chit, seemingly becomes entangled with the body and world, which are all jada, are all insentient. So this is the knot formed by the entanglement of awareness and non-awareness. I am and the body, the sat-chit and the body. So this is chit-jada-granti, bandham, it's bondage. That is all the limitations. Now we seem to be bound in time and space, and in so many ways we are bound, we are limited.
Michael, I'm getting a bit confused. As I get the chit-jada-granti, the knot between the I am and the insentient.
Yes.
This ego is the knot. But I'm losing the point that you made about the in-between. Is the ego the thing that's in-between? Is that what
you're saying? Ego is what's in-between.
Okay.
Ego is neither sat-chit nor is it the body. But it borrows the properties of both. It borrows its substance from sat-chit. That is, as ego, we feel I am. We're aware of our existence and we're aware. So both our existence, our being, and our awareness are borrowed from sat-chit.
So when I experience that queasy feeling, I'm experiencing the loss of that bot,
I'm coming to that. But I'm just trying to give paint a full picture. So I will come to that answer. So he says it's chit-jada-granti, it's bondage. It is jiva, it's the soul. It is nupame, the subtle body. It's this samsara, that is the whole of samsara. The root of all samsara is ego, so it all boils down to this ego. It is ahande, ego, and it is mind. That is what the mind essentially is only this ego. So in that verse, he's pointed out, ego is neither the body nor is it sat-chit, but something that rises in between, something that borrows the properties of both of them. It borrows its substance, its existence and its awareness from sat-chit, and it borrows its form from the body. So in the next verse, he describes ego as uravatrapeyahande, a formless phantom ego. It's formless because it's got no form of its own. And it's a phantom because it's got no substance of its own. It borrows its form from the body and it borrows its substance from sat-chit. So since it has neither form nor substance, it is just a formless phantom, Bhagavan describes it. So how does this formless phantom come into existence and seem to exist? That's what he talks about in this verse. He says, grasping form, it comes into existence. Grasping form, it stands. Grasping and feeding on form, it flourishes abundantly. Leaving form, it grasps form. So the very nature of ego is to always grasp form. because without grasping form, it cannot rise or stand. It depends upon it, because it has no form of its own, and also no substance of its own. It has to hold on to a form to have a seeming existence. And so long as it's holding on to form, it has a seeming existence. But after saying, leaving one form, it grasps another form, then Bhagavan says a very important sentence, Tadinal Opam Pidikam. If sought, it takes flight. That is, again, he's using these terms metaphorically. We're not literally seeking ego. What if sought there means if ego investigates itself. So instead of holding on to other things, if ego tries to catch hold of itself, Opam Pidikam, it takes flight. It runs away. Why? Because it has no substantive existence. It depends on form, on holding on to form for its seeming existence. Instead of holding forms, if it tries to hold itself, what it is holding, when it lets go of forms and tries to hold itself, it's only holding the Satchit. Because ego is actually nothing other than Satchit. Just like the snake is nothing other than a rope, ego is nothing other than Satchit. The difference between the snake and the rope is not a difference in substance there. It's only one thing there. But ego, the difference between the snake and the rope is just a difference in appearance, not a difference in substance. Likewise, the difference between ego and Satchit is just a difference in appearance, not a difference in substance. Because Satchit never rises. Satchit never is aware of itself as I am this body. Satchit is just that pure being and pure awareness, but always remains just as it is.
That what you're talking about reminds me of the king in the Wizard of Oz. So the lion in the Wizard of Oz.
Yes.
Once he's sought, he's exposed for what he is.
Yeah. So that Satchit, that is God. That is our. That is what God actually is, and it's our own reality. But because we have limited ourselves with this body, God seems to be something other than ourselves. That is, we so long as we are aware of ourselves as I am Robert or I am Michael, it's patently false to say I am God, because we're equating God with Robert or Michael. That I am the rest of Robert and Michael, that is God. So we are God in substance, but so long as we limit ourselves with this form, we seem to be something other than God, and therefore God seems to be something other than us. And all the functions that we attribute to God, creation, sustenance, dissolution, veiling, and grace, these are said to be the five functions of God, all these are true in our view. But actually, what is God's real nature is God is just being. God isn't actually doing anything. He is just being. But as Bhagavan explains in the 15th paragraph of Nana, just like the sun rises without liking, desire, or effort, but in its mere presence, so many things happen on earth. And just like in the mere presence of a magnet, a needle will move. Likewise, in the mere presence, by the mere special nature of the presence of God, in other words, by God's mere being, all these five functions are happening. So though God is described as Karta, a great doer, he actually doesn't do anything. It's by the mere power of his presence. It's only in our view that God seems to be a doer.
What were those five actions of God again, or those five functions of God?
Creation, sustenance, dissolution. That is, whatever has come into existence has to cease to exist. So all these, the creation of the world, the sustenance of the world, the maintenance of the world, and its eventual dissolution, all these are divine functions. The fourth one is Tirodhana. Tirodhana means veiling. All this seems to be true only so long as we are ignorant of our real nature. Because we are ignorant of our real nature, we mistake ourselves to be this body. And because we mistake ourselves to be this body, all these things seem to happen. So without that fundamental ignorance, none of these other functions or divine functions are possible. So one of the functions of God is keeping us in this ignorance. Why does God keep us in ignorance? God doesn't want us to be ignorant. We have so much liking for this state. We've got so many desires and attachments and so on. So until we are willing to surrender ourselves completely, he maintains this veil of ignorance. Only when we are willing to surrender ourselves completely will the fifth function, most important function, is the grace. That grace is working throughout this process. But so long as we have desire and attachment and so on, we are allowed, this veil of ignorance remains. But when we are willing to surrender ourselves completely, when we are willing to give up this small self that we now take ourselves to be, when we are willing to give ourselves entirely to God, then grace, the final act of grace takes place. Ego is annihilated and God alone remains.
May I jump in there? Yes. You used the word we, when yes. we, the yes. the illusion of the separateness, the I am yeah. Robert and I am Michael.
Yes.
That we, when we surrender the illusion yes. of that.
Yes.
I'm wondering if part of the, what's the word, the event, if you will, of awakening
yes.
is feels like surrender, feels like loss. And I'll tell you what, in my mind, as growing up as a Christian and being, as I told you, an Anglican priest, there's a lot of parallels. You almost were talking about the Genesis story
yes.
and Adam and Eve separating themselves and becoming other than.
Yes.
Yeah. This duality was even born then in Genesis.
These are all allegories, all these allegories.
Exactly.
They have a very deep meaning.
Yes. So back to this idea of we, the separate we. In one of my questions is, since there's only one fundamental substratum, Brahman, how is it then that when we reincarnate, yeah, this is what it was, there is something of what seems to be a separate me that echoes into future incarnations? I think I'm talking about sukshma sharira. How can it be that there seems to be a separate jiva or soul whose vasanas, fundamental incarnations, carry through to other incarnations? Again, I'm getting back to this many and one thing, I think.
Yes. that is, the jiva or the subtle body, as Bhagavan says, is nothing but ego. It's nothing but this false I that is neither the body nor satchit, but rises in between, borrowing the properties of both. This is ego. Ego cannot stand without grasping form. The first form the ego grasps is the form of a body that it takes to be itself. And only after taking this form to be itself, it's consequently aware of so many other forms. But though ego cannot stand without being aware of itself as I am this body, the body that it experiences itself need not be the same body. Now we experience this body as ourself. In dream, some other body we experience as ourself. So all these, according to Bhagavan, both waking and dream are both just dreams. In dreams, there's one dreamer. Well, dreamer is ego. As soon as we begin dreaming, we're aware of ourselves as a body and we're aware of the world. So in other words, as soon as we rise as ego, we project a body that we take to be ourselves, and consequently we see a world. So our whole life is one long dream. In this dream, we dream also that we have periods of sleep, and within that sleep, we also have dreams. So the dreams that we have at night are dreams within a dream. So our whole life, from the time Robert was born to the time Robert dies, that is one long dream. When the dream comes to an end, when Robert dies, Robert is just the form that ego was then taking to be itself, but ego projected and was then taking to be itself. The death of Robert is not sufficient, because so long as the ego remains, it will project some other person, some John or Jack or Krishnan or any, I mean, some other, or Amir or any name, that is some new name and form we take as ourselves. And it may be male, it may be female, it may be human, it may be animal, it may be in heaven, it may be in hell. These are all just different dreams. So long as the fundamental ignorance, the lack of awareness of ourselves as we actually are, continues, we will continue dreaming. And every life that we live is just another dream.
So, as you were talking, by the way, I suspect people listening to this, if they do, their mind will be jumping from one thing to the other. Your words, I must say, are provocative and evocative. They create all sorts of images.
Yes.
As a pastor, I'm retired now, you're always dealing with your own and other people's narratives, as they say, the stories of their lives.
Yeah.
And at one point in my career, I thought, this whole life is just stories.
Yes.
I mean, later in life, just recently, I've been saying, please stop the bloody stories, you know, that are going on in your head.
Yes.
Stop the stories, please. Yes. Just let it go. Surrender. And that's, I think, where I'm heading now. But I know where I'm heading.
But we identify ourselves with a story. When you are aware of yourself as Robert, you're not just aware of that body as yourself. You're aware of the whole story of Robert as yourself.
Right. So when you're helping people, as a pastor, as a psychologist, as a friend, you're listening to their stories and you're trying to reinterpret them, if you will, reimagine them to be in a healthy narrative. But there's also part of me, and I wonder many of us, want to say, just stop the bloody stories.
Yeah.
Yeah, but to do that, you lose this thing, as you use the word, grasping onto identity, something. Yeah,
the story is not the problem. The problem is our identification with that story.
With it, yeah.
Bhagavan is always bringing it back to what is the root problem. The root problem is our false identification.
Yeah.
And that which is identifying itself with this story is ego.
The funny thing, a question that may seem a bit crazy, but has anybody ever awakened in a dream? I mean, in a dream.
Yeah.
I know that everything's a dream.
It is perfectly possible.
Yeah.
That is, we can investigate ourselves in dream as well as we can investigate ourselves in this present state. But this present state, after all, is just a dream. So the awakening can happen at any time. But when the awakening happens, that is not only the end of the dreamer and all the dreams. That is, Bhagavan says in one verse, in the first verse of Ekamma Panchakam, Bhagavan says, forgetting oneself, taking oneself to be a body, and undergoing innumerable births, and eventually knowing and being oneself, is just like waking from a dream of in which one has wandering all over the world. So that when we awaken, it is compared to awakening of a dream, but there is a fundamental difference between the ordinary waking from a dream and the real waking. Normally, when we wake up from a dream, we are waking from one dream into another dream.
Right.
But in that state, we are in the true awakening, we are not waking from one dream to another dream. We are waking from dream to the reality. And that reality is our own existence, our own awareness. When we know ourselves as we actually are, we will know that we were always that. That's why Bhagavan often used to say, jnana is not a new knowledge to be attained. We're not going to gain anything. We're going to lose everything. The problem we face now is not the lack of jnana. It is the ajnana that we superimposed upon the jnana. That jnana means the pure awareness, I am. The ignorance that we've superimposed on that is the false awareness, I am this body.
So when I look at Bhagavan's and I read his writings and so forth, and I look into his eyes in the images that we have, thank God, and the one you've got up on your screen, there is that sense of complete self-possession. And I don't mean narcissistic.
When I try
to imagine what that might. And I understand it's not an experience because you're inside you are the thing, you are the being. So it's not like you can experience it.
Yeah.
But it seems to me that that's why when people say he looked at me and I awoke or I had that feeling of awakening, I think there's something so fundamentally ontological. That's a technical term, but something so intimate, so real, so profound, that when you come into that presence, it's you. It's you, and you just say,
Bhagavan was very thinly disguised.
It
is God. It is our own reality, but appeared in that form. But he was so thinly in our, because of our ignorance, we take him to be that form. But actually, he is that pure awareness that is ever shining in our heart as I, has appeared outwardly in that form in order to turn within. So when we look in his eyes, I know what you mean by self-possession. I would say there's such a settled look, such a deep and...
settled, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. There's no chalana, no. It's like a lake with not a single ripple on it.
Yeah.
It is so calm and so so well established, settled.
How is it, Michael? I mean, you've spent a lifetime, largely a lifetime, practicing. Who am I?
Yes.
Who am I? And you did, right, I think it was, I can never remember his name, Goddard, Peter Goddard. Is it Peter Goddard?
David Godman, I think.
Godman. Yeah. David Godman. Yeah, David Godman. This idea that, you know, each of us are, I think what I'm trying to, let me get to this point. I think towards the end of my life, I'm 70, almost 73, as I approach the end of my life, there's a sense in which I'm approaching the culmination of a lifetime like yours of studying this stuff and trying to understand it, and trying to understand yourself and trying to help people become yourself, become free, peaceful, contented.
Yeah.
And the closer I come to this, the more I want, it's self-fulfilling itself. The more I want, more I reach in, the deeper I want to get.
Yes.
It's very captivating.
Yes.
I would encourage anybody watching this to believe what I just said and to just persevere in the practice. Do you want to say anything about that, Michael?
Yeah, perseverance is the only way. It's the only way we can succeed. You said I've spent a lifetime practicing this. If I had spent a lifetime practicing it, my story would have been over by now. I have spent a lifetime trying to practice this, but because of the strength of Vishayavasanas, my mind is still keeps on going out and holding on to things outside. So it is a process. That is this practice of self-investigation and self-surrender. This is a process. We are slowly weaning ourselves off our likes, dislikes, desires, attachments, and so on. And we are weaning ourselves off that and at the same time cultivating that love just to be as we actually are. So how long this takes us all depends upon where we are when we start. If we start off with strong Vishayavasanas, obviously it'll take more time to wean ourselves off. If we start off with fewer Vishayavasanas, then it'll take less time. But those who have fewer Vishayavasanas, they have fewer Vishayavasanas because they've already been traveling this journey for some time. So we are all on a journey. Where exactly we stand on this journey, we don't know. But we can be fairly sure once we've come to this path, this is the ultimate path. So if we've been drawn to this path, we are at least getting near the end of our journey.
Is there a group that you're aware of, or groups, or an organization, or multiple organizations that you're aware of, where people who are of the similar mindset that you and I obviously are, where we are now in terms of our understanding, to support one another in this journey? Not that becomes the thing becomes the thing.
Yeah.
But that the discovery, the investigation, that becomes the thing. And as people experience, like you and I have shared today.
Yeah.
I mean, it's been very, very, what's the word, comforting, encouraging to me to hear you say what you've said.
Yeah.
That sort of encouragement, I think, is necessary in everybody's life, in all of our lives.
Yeah.
Is there a group, I mean, when we go to church, for instance, that's part of a huge part of renewing, discovering the spiritual journey. Hey, you were in any group like that?
Informally, yes. That is there are people like us all over the world who have been drawn to Bhagavan and are following this path. Every month, there are a number of groups I talk with. There's a group here in London. There's a group in Delhi. There's a group in Houston. There's a group in San Diego. And there are other groups that I talk to with occasionally. So there is a very loose network. And I talk with many individuals. I mean, every day I'm getting emails from people asking questions about this and so on. And I communicate by WhatsApp and by Signal. And so there are... I mean, obviously, we're in a very small minority because this is a path that will not attract everyone because not everyone is yet ready for it. That's fine. I mean, this is not something that we don't have to proselytize. Exactly. That is, when people are ready, they'll be drawn to this path.
And so you have a sense of destiny, am I right? That everything that is going to happen is going to happen.
Yes, definitely.
So people that come to this, watch this Zoom, this video, will be because they were destined to. Is that what you're saying?
Yes. I wouldn't even say they come to me, they come to Bhagavan. I just happen to be...
You're a vehicle,
Yeah, at most. Even that I hesitate to say, because who am I to say that? So,
that's beautiful.
For those who are serious in following this path, peer-to-peer support is available, let's say.
Yeah.
I mean, just like you and I are talking, I talk with so many people, and I'm really no better than anyone else. I just happened to have been fortunate that I did live 20 years in Tiruvannamalai. I was with Sadhu Om. I walked around Arunachal every day for nearly 20 years. And somehow Bhagavan has given me this, because Bhagavan's teaching actually are very, very simple. It's not difficult to understand Bhagavan's teaching. All we need to do is to be willing to let go of our ideas, of our old beliefs and assumptions and so on, and begin to view things, because the picture of what Bhagavan has painted of our life is actually an extremely simple picture. For example, I spoke to you about verses 24 and 25 of Udinapadu. In verse 26, Bhagavan says, if ego comes into existence, everything comes into existence. If ego doesn't exist, everything doesn't exist. Ego itself is everything. Therefore, investigating what it is giving up everything. Why is investigating what it is giving up everything? Because the nature of ego is to rise, stand, and flourish by attending to things other than itself, but to subside and dissolve back into its source by attending to itself. So when we investigate what is this ego, ego will thereby subside. And since everything else depends upon ego, everything else will subside. So this is, you cannot have simpler metaphysics than the metaphysics Bhagavan has given us.
Let me respond to that. I agree with you. It's absurdly simple.
Yes.
It's crazily simple. Yeah. But how, when I begin at 6 o'clock at my time in Seattle, and I begin to say, who am I? And I close my eyes and I curl up and I try to draw into myself. Sometimes at the end of 2 hours, an hour, it's just been work. Yeah. Yeah. And then there'll be times when I just feel this extreme, exquisite, almost frightening closeness, intimacy.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
There's excitement and there's also, oh, shoot, this is scary. Is that feeling? And so when I look at some people that are completely out there all the time,
yeah,
for them to come to that place of profound personalness, intimacy with you, deep down, well, it's hard. I can't find words for it. It must be very, very hard. So there's comforting. There's comfort in the thought that if not this life,
yeah,
then the next life or the life after, and so forth. Yeah. Yeah.
That is, we can investigate ourselves only right. to the extent to which we are willing to surrender, willing to let go of everything that we're holding on to. So long as we are still attached to other things, so long as we're still holding on to other things, we are unwilling to go within.
Do you see how that echoes with Christianity?
Yes.
You know, lose yourself, let go of yourself.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. Exactly, yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Truth can't be otherwise. That is, it's so simple and so blindingly obvious, but there must be that willingness on our part to let go. For those people who are very, very outward, they won't even be willing to begin this path. So I was saying earlier how very simple Bhagavan's teachings are. Not only is the metaphysics of Bhagavan's teaching so simple, but practice is so simple. Because all it is just to be self-attentive. That's all that is required.
But it's very frightening. I'm going to say this. I think most people are frightened.
I'll come to that also.
Yeah, yeah.
Why it seems so difficult to us, it's because of our lack of willingness. Because by holding on to ourselves, by being self-attentive, we are letting go of everything. Which is, so long as the ego still has some, so long as the Vishaya-vasanas are still there, so long as we still have an inclination to hold on to other things, it is frightening. It is frightening. But one thing, we need have no fear. Bhagavan will not kill us until we are 100% willing to be killed by him. That is, the jnana will be attained only when we surrender ourselves with full willingness. So we will not let go until we are ready to let go. When we let go, it will be the greatest of all reliefs.
You know, that's a great place to stop.
Yeah.
I want to thank you, Michael. You've you're a bloody beautiful man, and I thank you for giving yourself. And you've got to receive this. I understand.
I plead innocence. None of this is me. It's all Bhagavan.
I'm sorry, but I'm going to say thank you. You're a bloody beautiful man. And I hope and pray that you stay on this earth or stay in this story for a while longer.
Wow, that's so that all in Bhagavan's hands.
I understand. It's my prayer, and that others will be blessed by it. Thank you.
Bhagavan was, people would come and offer Bhagavan very costly pens, Schaeffers or Parkers or things. Bhagavan said, no, take it to the office. There they've got many important things to write. They've got accounts and all their things to write. They will have use for that. I'm satisfied with my old leaky pen. And often he would cut off the borders of newspapers and stitch into small notebooks and write his verses. So he, Bhagavan, will use the most worthless instruments to do the most wonderful things. So if at all he's using me as an instrument, it's no credit to myself. It is entirely his grace. Because I can assure you, I am totally unworthy.
I hear you.
That is, to others, how we appear may be different, but each of us know in our heart of hearts how strong our vasanas still are. There's a beautiful prayer in one of the verses of Arunachala Patikam. That's 11 verses that Bhagavan wrote to Arunachala. In all, there are five hymns. This is one of the five. In verse 9, Bhagavan, in the first line of verse 9, Bhagavan sings, Paramanim padum patrarapatrum paravari variaril paraman. That means he's addressing Arunachala, O Supreme. I am the supreme among those who are destitute of the supreme wisdom to cling without attachment to your feet. So when Bhagavan sang that, he is echoing the heart of every true devotee. We all are painfully aware of how much we're lacking in true love to follow this path, how much we still have so much attachment to the world and our unwillingness to cling without attachment to his feet. His feet means that which is shining in our heart as eye. If we really had that, if we were really willing to cling to his feet, we would let go of all other attachments, but we're still holding on to other things. So Bhagavan has expressed so beautifully there the state of, this will apply to all of us. So long as we're on this path, definitely we will feel ourselves to be the most unworthy. And it's true, we're completely unworthy. It's all entire. The fact that we've been even drawn to this path is entirely grace, by grace. And grace is nothing but we're all embracing love, because Bhagavan doesn't see us as anything other than himself. So he loves us as himself. That love that he has for us as himself is what we experience as grace.
Mm-hmm. Amen. Thank you.
All thanks to Bhagavan.
Amen. God bless. Bye-bye.
Right.